Good afternoon. Welcome to You in the Ring on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. And we stream live on the internet at cfuv.uvic.ca. You can also like us on Facebook and you can follow us on Twitter. My name is Brian and I'm here with co-host Colin, and we're guest hosting today on a rather special episode of You in the Ring. We're doing a double feature to help launch the autumn issue, both of the Malahat Review and the St. John, New Brunswick-based The Fiddlehead. And it's all because the Malahat Review's autumn issue, issue number 180, is entitled Essential East Coast Writing, while The Fiddlehead's equivalent, issue number 253, is featuring West Coast writers. In other words, East covers West and West covers East. And with us today in the studio for the first half of the show is one of the contributors to the Fiddlehead's tribute to West Coast writer Steve Noyes. And in the second half of the show, we'll be joined on the telephone by John Threlfall, who is the Special Projects and Communications Officer for UVic's Faculty of Fine Arts. We'll be talking to John about his varied career and his workshop called Writing the Arts, and we'll tell you more about that later. Now, a bit about Steve Noyes, who's beside me here. He's published 7 books of poetry and fiction in voices as various as Omar Khayyam, basketball star Allen Iverson, a Chaucer professor, and a 9th century Chinese bureaucrat. Al Purdy said after reading his first book, "Noyes is a damn good poet." His most recent books are his poetry collection, Rainbow Stage Manchuria, and his first novel, It Is Just That Your House Is So Far Away. He was raised in Winnipeg. He's a graduate of UBC's MFA writing program and Carleton's Journalism School. He's published more than 100 poems, stories, and book reviews. His writing appears regularly in such magazines and newspapers as, of course, the Malahat Review, the Fiddlehead, Event, the Globe and Mail, Queen's Quarterly, and the Vancouver Sun. Steve has won writing grants from BC Arts Council and the Canada Council. He's also worked as foreign expert, more on that later, policy analyst, parking lot attendant, printing press grunt, disabilities advocate, sessional lecturer, this is a long and varied list, correspondence writer, plywood mill laborer, and editor. And over the past decade, Noyes has worked and studied in Beijing, Shanghai, Taipei, Qingdao, and a little town north of Beijing. He's traveled extensively across China. He studied Mandarin at Fudan University in Shanghai and holds an international Mandarin proficiency certificate. But we're doing today's interview in English, I presume. He's married to the poet Catherine Greenwood. She's also a contributor to Fiddlehead Review and currently makes his home in Victoria, where he just told us in the prep room here that he's recently puzzled out another novel. It's in the mail to a would-be publisher, and he's working for the BC Ministry of Health. Steve, welcome to CFUV.
Thanks very much, Brian. I didn't realize I had done so many jobs. Anyway, I'm delighted to be on the show.
I'm out of breath already. We haven't started yet. But I want to come back to that little tidbit in your bio, a foreign expert. It's not a job description you read for anyone in Canada particularly. Can you just tell us a bit what that entailed?
Sure, Brian. A foreign expert is someone that is forbidden to talk about politics, religion, and most aspects of North American culture. It actually is a glorified way of saying that I was teaching English at these Chinese universities, and they reserve the foreign expert essentially teaches conversation, pronunciation, and literature, and how to write. The things that the Chinese professors who have studied English, and their English is very good, nonetheless don't have insight into how North Americans actually use the language. So that's what they use foreign experts for.
So it's not something to how to conduct yourself at a cocktail party or...
No. How to be really good at being foreign. Of course, you do get an extensive education in how to be foreign when you live in China for any period of time. Yeah. I enjoyed teaching in China.
And you were there for quite a number of years.
I was there for, in all, about 4 years and 3 different stints, yeah.
And how's the Mandarin? Is it...
I can speak all right, yeah.
That's pretty good. Let's come to your writing and your most recent book, Rainbow Stage Manchuria. It's a long poem work about a fictional rock concert, maybe that's the connection to the Guess Who, and an exiled Chinese woman in northern China. Can you somehow bring that together? And I've seen the cover, it's on your website. So it's psychedelic in nature.
Yeah, I really like the sort of bell-bottom font that they used on the cover, the hand-drawn font. It gives the feel of the rock posters of the era. The book, Rainbow Stage Manchuria, is 2 long poems. The first one, very long, it's 80 pages, and I tried to recreate 1973 rock concert by a fictional rock band called The Next. Now, I was inspired by the Guess Who, though. I went to the Guess Who's live performance at Kildonan Park in 1973, and I was 13 years old. My father was a bit of a paperback mystic, and he was convinced that rock music was lowering the spiritual vibration in our house. So it took quite a bit of begging for him to allow me to go to this concert, and I remembered it for a long time. 35 years later, I spent some 80 pages trying to create something like that rock concert.
And the link to an exiled Chinese woman, I don't know if you call it a plot in a too long poem book, but link those two.
Well, at the end of one of Terry Ransom's interviews in the rock concert poem, he's asked, "Why is your music full of so much bitterness?" And he says, "Maybe we're anxious for something that hasn't happened yet. And personally, maybe I hope it won't happen, but it's something that will complete us or make us whole." And the interviewer goes, "What do you mean?" He goes, "Well, like Christmas." The Chinese woman who is delivering a long, long lament about her political struggles in China and how it's affected the relationship with her family also has intimate knowledge of that sort of hard-won bitterness, but also some hope.
And the title, is it meant to be two distinct titles, like Rainbow Stage / Manchuria?
Yeah, it was originally a slash, but I changed it to a hyphen. I somehow liked the suggestion that perhaps Rainbow Stage could be lifted out and placed into modern China. No one has reviewed the book yet, and perhaps they'll want to analyze what the connections are between the two poems.
Now, just before we leave, I don't want to leave China, but Ghost Country, which is a book you put out in 2006, also about China.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a continuum there somehow.
I've written now three and possibly four, I haven't published the fourth one yet, books touching on my experience in China, or at least using my experiences in China. And I think I've come to the end of that road, actually. For a foreigner, even one who has some knowledge of Mandarin, there are some things you don't really understand when you're in China, and you probably never will. It's time to move on to writing more about my North American experience, I think. But it's been fun.
And you said you just recently puzzled out another novel. Is that a North American one? The one that's in the mail, perhaps, to a...
Actually, it's, as the Chinese would say, yiban, yiban. It's half and half. Part of the novel concerns three performance artists who try to make a moving hologram in modern China. But their attempt runs afoul of a government anti-corruption campaign. The other half of the novel is about the funding of an anti-anxiety drug in Canada. So there are some surprises in how those two are connected. Yeah.
A moving hologram, you mean the actual physical projection of a image?
Yes, that moves.
And an anti-anxiety drug.
Yeah.
Linked together, okay.
Perhaps art is a drug that helps us to relieve some of our anxieties, and perhaps not. Perhaps it exacerbates them. These were some of the ideas I was playing with, yeah. There's also the question of that a lot of people write about how corrupt China is, but in some respects our society has its levels and layers of corruption too, and I wanted to explore that a bit.
As we're hearing play out daily from Montreal. Your first novel, It Is Just That Your House Is So Far Away, and I should tell people that you can watch a little trailer for it on YouTube if you put that in, but tell us a bit about that, and particularly the title, because again, that has a connection with China as well.
It Is Just That Your House Is So Far Away comes from a small story that occurs in the Lunyu, or the Analects of Confucius. A boy comes to Confucius to complain that he really did love his girlfriend, but it was just that her house was so far away, and Confucius answered, "You do not really love her. You know, had you loved her, you would not have cared about the distance." And in that novel, I was drawing on a relationship that I had with a Beijing girl. I was engaged to her for about a year or so, and we mutually decided not to get married. There were a lot of barriers, but I remember her with fondness.
That's a good title, now that you've explained it. It's The Wisdom of Confucius. You're a contributor to this special issue of the Fiddlehead Review. because they're featuring West Coast writers. And I think you brought along a couple of selections from there of your contributions.
Yeah, correct? I have a couple of poems to read. Okay. I should say I was at University of New Brunswick not long ago to participate in their poetry weekend, and that was very nice in a way, a good introduction to that kind of cross-fertilization that's going on with these two issues. I met some people from the Maritimes that I've corresponded with but never met before. It was delightful.
Just let me pick up on that before you read.
Yeah.
What did you say, poetry weekend?
Mm-hmm. 24 poets, about 16 hours of readings, and two awesome parties.
That's quite an event.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Took me a couple of days to recover. I'm going to read The Proselytizers. Two Korean girls came calling and wanted to speak about holy matters. Sir, do you know holy matters? Both overdressed, the younger in a smart wool coat with big buttons, the elder in a thrift store windbreaker. Thank you, we do not need a water. I sat them down, the younger ready to share these holy matters, clutching her precious three-ring book. I got the pictures. Cerulean, of course. Canned salmon flesh. Chocolate foil gold. Sun rays burst from figures in the tipped-in illustrations, and a hard glue bubble underneath mild Mary's robes and creases crossed the lamb. The younger's hair was a smooth helmet, her lips small and full, pink flanges on a cowrie, the elder silent. Material world equals reflection of heaven. Bride plus father equals God. Lamb plus blood equals eternal life. The elder shifted, eyes vying with her cheekbones for a humility, and got an awkwardness. It all added up, plus sign after plus sign page. This is the lamb, sir. It equals holy, but I cut her off. If earth is the reflection, yada yada, then why is heaven so fraught with war and greed? She blinked, turned the page. Last Supper. Sir, you know this picture? I sure as fuck did, but stopped myself because the elder was gazing at my thoughts. The lamb, he always disappointed. His picture in my father's den was always staring off as if he, too, were ultimately bored with father. They traded looks, and his hair was far too wavy. I bet he used a flat iron from Rexall. The younger closed the book. Her character rose in her makeup. The elder tipped pity from eye to eye, like white from yolk. I'm glad that you believe in God, I said. Good luck with your mission, but my religion doesn't permit what you're doing. The younger frowned at mission. The elder sat up straight in her assessment of me. It fit her like a throne. So, books slipped into purse, buttons thumbed in eyelets, zipper tugged up stations of its teeth. Neither wanted juice or tea. It's hard to recognize a waste of time, but they add up. Goodbye. Goodbye. They left the door half open.
Very nice, and I'm hearing that for the first time because, believe it or not, we couldn't score a copy of the Fiddlehead Review before today's show, and even the Malahat Review offices here hadn't received their customary copy, so thank you. Thank you for reading that.
Oh, you're very welcome.
And you had two contributions to
that issue. I did, to the Fiddlehead,
yeah. So we just move right on in?
Sure. This poem is called Mudroom, and there's a reference in it about halfway through to the 1970s movie The Deer Hunter. Mudroom. So my friend asked me, what kind of girls do you like? And I said, not the sort who make a point of taking you to see their girlfriend who is large and plain and living in a polar cold prairie town with her boyfriend in a mudroom, although I believe she had access to a kitchen, and everyone is drinking spiked coffee and wearing parkas. They eloped not long ago to live their ground chuck lives out working for the Shell station and the Pick-a-Mickey. And the girl has found great joy earning points towards Shell gifts to round out their marriage, like NHL tumblers and commemorative flatware. If you don't like these folksy-type poems rooted in place proceeding from lame anecdotes, too bad, it was damn cold in there. And my friend said, you don't need heat when you have love. Still, those are not the girls I like. I see, she said. And it occurred to me that even Vietnam vets in an imaginary Pennsylvania steel town, say, who couldn't master high school, shouldering sideways towards a smorgasbord of hopelessness, were better off than that girl and her beau, cross-legged in the mudroom. And so what girls do you like, said my friend. Well, there were a couple standing on chairs in a food court, singing their throats out in the Hallelujah Chorus, exemplary carbon-based life forms on the far edge of the rocky, icy universe. Yes, the machine shop, terribly cold pavilion, outbuilding of the strange map dreamed long ago by Polynesians, singing they would live forever and ever, their eyes and smiles alight from has-been stars. Already I don't like them, she said.
Thank you. And I couldn't help but notice you're reading that from your latest book. Are those excerpts from the longer poem?
No, they were from the middle section. There are two long poems, and in the middle I have some individual poems.
Yeah. So that's Steve Noyes, our guest today, reading from his two contributions that were selected for the current autumn issue of the Fiddlehead Review. But you've also brought with you, I think, a selection from the Malahat Review's autumn issue, for which we're dedicating the show. And that's a poem by Steve McCormand. And I'll let you just give the title and get on.
Okay, Steve McCormand is a really fine poet. I've known him for a number of years. In fact, we trade poems back and forth and offer each other suggestions sometimes. He's from Prince Edward Island. He now lives in Toronto. And he went to University of New Brunswick and did his master's there. I really like Steve's work for its terse tone. The poem I'm going to read is called They. They love the idea of trees and occasionally to stroll among them. They loved how quiet the city when it snowed and the view from the air as they flew. Sleek and laminar, they hurtled from one instant to the next. They had been given a broad mandate, subdue the continents, the sea and sky, fortify the savage border. It was written. They were the bee's knees, the mutt's nuts. Their enlightenment was collateral. They recalibrated the detectors. They perfected the machine-human interface. They left their footprints in the dust of other worlds. They didn't know what they didn't know. They disabled the fail-safes. They reverse-engineered the Big Bang. They reintroduced the wolves. They mea culpa'd towards the door. And they love to dance.
Lovely poem, and there's a word in there I'll look up, laminar, sleek and laminar. Okay, I'll get my Oxford Dictionary out on that one. Thank you, and we're almost running out of time, believe it or not. Steve doesn't have the benefit of the clock that I do, which is on the wall behind his head, but I just want to come back to one of your biographies that I read online. It said, at one point very earlier in your career, you were a poet for hire. You put an ad in the student newspaper. I can see Steve's eyes sort of,
when was that?
Did you get any takers?
I did. Actually, that was in the Winnipeg Sun. I placed an ad, and I did have one customer. I charged her $25 to write a sonnet to her fiancé. She wanted to give him a love poem, so I did write one. And I was, I think, 18 years old at the time, and my sonnet was really quite dreadful. But she loved it, and I made $25. I thought, boy, you know, things are really looking rosy for the future.
You know, on a per-word basis, that's not bad.
Do the
calculation there, you know, on a per-line basis.
Minimum wage at the time was $2.85 an hour, so I might have made more than, you know, for the first time in my career, I might have made more than minimum wage writing a poem. You
know. Any final words? I know you've been reading recently a Planet Earth poetry, You've been a former teacher of creative writing here. Any last words before we move on to our next guest?
Well, I'd be very interested if readers who pick up Rainbow Stage Manchuria and absorb the two long poems, I would be very interested if they could tell me what the connections are between a 1973 rock concert and a long lament by an exiled woman in northern China. Sometimes when you write these things, you don't really know what they're about until some time has passed. Maybe someone will enlighten me. I live in hope.
I live in hope and Victoria. Thank you, Steve. And on the line is John Threlfall. He's a specialist in the arts and popular culture. He spent a decade working backstage in live theater before he attended the University of Victoria, where he was working on his master's in history until 1999, when he was picked up as a staff writer for Monday Magazine. He stayed until 2010 there as, variously, calendar editor, arts editor, in-house theater critic, and ultimately 4 years as editor-in-chief. He also spent 5 seasons as the on-air walking encyclopedia of popular culture for CBC Radio 1's Definitely Not the Opera, or DNTO. He spent more than 20 years as a freelance magazine writer. He's taught university-level courses on such diverse topics as writing creative nonfiction, the history of the disc jockey, the representation of witchcraft in popular culture, and many others. He's currently the Special Projects and Communications Officer for UVic's Faculty of Fine Arts. He was one of 6 Canadian Gen Xers featured in the NFB documentary Le Temple X, or Dis. He was a co-host of Canadian Biker Television, co-authored the quirky guidebook Victoria Secrets of the City for Arsenal Pulp Press, nominated for an Alternative Association of Newsweekly's Award, and he's currently co-president of the Board of Directors for Intrepid Theatre. He's also ridden a motorcycle solo from Mile Zero, Victoria, to Mile Zero in St. John's, Newfoundland, and back. He's a frequent instructor and guest speaker at various colleges and schools. I think I'll stop there, John, because we'll run out of time. I'll just run out of time.
It's just too much. When you hear it all like that, it makes me feel like I'm like 70 or something.
It's longer than Steve Noyes, I think.
Yeah, I guess so. Crazy.
Okay, and one thing not listed on your biography there is that you're teaching a course for the Department of Writing starting in January, specifically on music writing. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, well, I did this for the writing department a couple summers ago. It was one of their summer courses, and it was very popular. And we decided to expand it out and put it into the main calendar. You know, as you probably know, the Department of Writing specializes in all sorts of different things, poetry, drama, creative nonfiction. And they do journalism courses as well. And often it's nice to do specifically niche courses. And arts writing is one of those niches, but even to boil it down further, music writing is a good niche to do a course about, because a lot of people, that's how they get into writing in the first place. How many people do you know who started out by, you know, writing CD reviews or band reviews or covering a gig or something like that, and then started, you know, interviewing rock stars, and then you move up the ladder from there, and the next thing you know, you're doing bigger things. So it's a great way to get into the business, and it's an easy way for students to really learn about writing about the arts, because you can do small things, you can do big things, you can do personal things, you can do interview things. There's a lot of different ways to do it.
I'm reminded, as you say that, about that great film, Almost Famous, about the young kid who started writing sort of anonymously for Rolling Stone.
Yeah. Well, and if you don't know the backstory to that, Cameron Crowe, who directed the film, who's directed a number of Hollywood films, Vanilla Sky and that one and a couple of other things, he was that kid. That's the true story behind the film. When he was a young teenager, his mom had skipped him a couple of grades, and he graduated from high school, and he had this body of knowledge about music, and he did approach Lester Bangs, and he did start writing for Rolling Stone. And that's the fascinating thing about that movie, and I use that movie in my class because it is the best movie about music writing that's ever been made, but it shows that a passion for music can really lead you somewhere down the road. I mean, we're not all going to become famous like Cameron Crowe is, but, you know, you can do quite well for yourself with it.
You can, and speaking of which, even narrowing it down even more, and one reason we wanted you to come on today is to give an unabashed plug for your upcoming workshop. Instead of me telling everyone about it, can you please do that?
It's a lot of what we were just talking about. So it's just a little short workshop on writing about the arts, which I love doing because I find, you know, certainly, okay, you know, backstory, having been at Monday Magazine, having been at CBC, having been at all these places over the years, we all know the cutbacks that have been going on in mainstream journalism, in any kind of journalism over the last few years. And the arts is often where the cuts come first. You know, people get cut from their beat instead of having For example, when I started the paper, we had a jazz writer, we had a hip-hop writer, we had a rock writer, we had a folk music writer, we had an opera writer, we had a theater writer. Like, they were all these niches that people had specialized bodies of knowledge in. And then as budget cuts came and the crunching started, one by one, they were dropped. So suddenly, you went from having a whole field of specialists that you could send out to cover something, and they would speak from their body of knowledge and speak intelligently about it, and the readers really appreciated that. You were dropped down to a field of generalists, where suddenly, you know, literally, it was me who had to write about all this stuff. And you're suddenly you're scrambling. It's like, oh, I got to interview this hip-hop writer or hip-hop performer. What do I know about hip-hop? I know a bit about it. Let's do some crash studying and figure out what I don't know. Read some other interviews. Figure it out really fast on the fly. So basically, I have a passion for arts writing, and I want to spread that passion and make sure that other people are, you know, remain passionate about it as well. And I find by doing these workshops, it's a great way to do that. Enthusiasm is often infectious. You know, I've done these in the past for, you like, the Nexus newspaper at Camosun and the Martlet here at UVic. And I always enjoy talking to people about the arts. And, you know, the good thing about it is people think that as the mainstream press crunches down, there are less opportunities available, which may be true on that level. But as the Internet opens up, there are more opportunities available there. When you think about when I started freelancing, this is going back to the, you know, 80s, early, mid-80s, when I first sent out my first few things, they were written on a typewriter, and they were sent out in the mail with stamps. Like, email wasn't a thing yet. The personal computer wasn't even a thing yet. And I'm not an old guy. Like, I'm only 48. And things have changed so fast that now there are more opportunities all the time opening up online. So while you might not be able to freelance for, say, Monday Magazine that much anymore, now you can freelance online more. And you can. There are opportunities there. And, hell, you can start your own publication. There's an interesting thing going on over in fine arts right now in the School of Writing. They've started this online publication called Coastal Spectator. And they're turning it into a little online arts magazine where they'll go out and they'll review shows and they'll interview people. And it's all about arts writing. So I'm hoping a number of their contributors come to the talk as well.
Are you implying that you can actually freelance for money doing that? Or is this more along the hobby? Is there actually money to be made in writing for the arts, in your opinion, now, with even on the Internet?
Well, I mean, you got to define your terms. Is there money to be made? There is money to be made, but what kind of money are we talking about? I mean, I know HMV, for example, the record store, they have a site where you can become a music writer, and you can write 50, 100 words on whatever the topic is you get assigned, and you get paid for that. You don't get paid a lot for that. You probably get paid like $25 for that, but you get paid for that. So, I mean, does it matter how much you're getting paid, or is it more a question of valuing your work and putting it out there and getting something back for that? Coastal Spectator right now, I believe, is paying content. Again, it's not a lot of money. It's probably $15-$20, but they are paying something, which is better than a lot of publications right now. If they're accepting freelancers, a lot of publications don't pay anything at all. I still do a lot of writing for free. Like, I do most of the freelance work I do is paid, and honestly, most of it is pretty well paid because I've been doing it for 20-odd years. But I still do writing for free around town for arts things that I really believe in because it's a good way of just getting the word out about stuff. Like, if I have the choice of, you know, championing an arts event that otherwise is not going to get covered, I'll do that for free just to help them out. You know, like, as opposed to saying, well, I'm not going to write about that because I'm not getting paid.
Is your workshop, the Writing the Arts, is it, again, on a one-night session, you're not going to be doing writing exercises? How do you approach it? Is it more the mechanics of getting contacts and how to do it as opposed to the actual skill or craft of writing?
Yeah, it's a real scattershot effect. You know, we'll talk a bit about my background and how I got started and then what I've done over the years. And, yeah, we'll talk about the practicalities of how do you reach out to an editor? How do you pitch an article? Like, how do you approach somebody? How do you approach a magazine when you have no freelance credits? What do you say in your cover letter in that kind of a situation? We'll talk about things like developing a niche, what I was saying earlier about developing a niche for yourself. Yes, we can all be generalists, and we all should be generalists these days, but everybody has a niche. If I had to boil down my niches, I would say, you know, I'm a theater writer because I've spent arguably 30 years in and around theater. I would say I'm a music writer because I've spent a number of years, you know, writing about music and interviewing people. And to niche it down even further, I'm a James Bond specialist, so which sounds ridiculous. But, you know, right now, for example, with the 50th anniversary of the James Bond series going on, I've written one piece that ran in the Globe and Mail about James Bond, and I've been interviewed by three other magazines about the James Bond film legacy, because people know that's my niche. So if you develop these kind of niches and get your work out there, and people know that that's what you know about, especially if it's something kind of obscure, they'll come to you, and suddenly you'll be in that wonderful position that all freelancers want to be in, is where people are knocking on your door instead of you knocking on their door.
And speaking of which, I want to take you back through the time machine to when you were, in a sense, doing that as the walking encyclopedia of popular culture for DNTO. How did you approach that exercise?
It was James Bond that got me into it. And it just sounds crazy now. But, okay, so this was years ago. Let's go back. Let's go way back to the time after Timothy Dalton, before Pierce Brosnan, when the James Bond series was on hiatus. And, you know, there's been a number of years there where a Bond film hadn't come out. And then they were, you know, starting again with Pierce Brosnan. And at that time, you know, people were interested again. And I've got this James Bond collection. I've got this body of music in my collection. And I've been listening to DNTO for a number of years. So I just pitched them an article. And I said, hey, you know, I've got this, all this James Bond music. The new Bond movie is coming out. You know, people love James Bond music. Why don't we do a short piece about the musical legacy of James Bond and call it The Man with Golden Beat? And the producer called me up. He said, hey, that sounds like a great idea. I had pitched it as a 10-minute thing, and he said, did I have enough music to stretch it out to an hour? And I said, sure, I can do that. I've got lots of music, you know, and I got a head full of knowledge about Bond and everything. Do you want me to just write it up and submit it, and then, you know, your people can take the piece? And he's like, well, no, we're talking on the phone. You've got a good voice. Why don't you just come on the air and talk about it? You seem passionate about the subject. So I did that. It went really well. We had a good conversation. It worked out well on air. They liked the musical treats and everything like that. And then when we were done, he said, oh, great. What else you got? So I pitched him on something else. And then I pitched him on something else. And then, you know, it just built into me being a regular monthly columnist for them, where every month I had a different topic. And every month I had an hour of airtime. And across Canada, people were listening to me. And everybody was like, how did you get that gig? That's such a great dream gig. I'm like, well, I just approached them and I said, you know, this is what I can do and this is what I can say and here's what we can listen to. And because it fit their publication or because it fit their show, it worked, you know. And this is one of the things I talk about in the workshop as well. It's like, if you're going to pitch to a publication, if you're going to pitch to a TV show, a radio show, whatever it may be, you have to know your product. You have to know what they're looking for and then provide that and know what they've done and what they haven't done and provide that for them. So, you know, on the one hand, sure, they thought I was brilliant because I was this walking encyclopedia of pop culture, but in reality, I just do good research. And a lot of that comes out of the fact that, you know, my undergrad, and then you'd mentioned in the intro when I was working on my master's, it was in history, where they teach you how to research really well. So I just applied those research skills to my freelancing, and it's worked out really well for me over the years.
As you're speaking, though, it's a very different kind of writing than the stereotype of the novelist who spends just a lot of time alone writing, as compared to this kind of writing, where in a sense you've got to make all these contacts and be skilled at interviewing and so forth, whether you're going to do it in writing or, like you did it as well, on radio. There's that part of it, which I think is what you also cover in your workshop.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, knowing how to give a good interview is an invaluable skill. It's not that it's an easy skill. It's a skill that you can pick up as time goes on, because with every interview you do with somebody, you just get better at it over the years. So, you know, I talk about some good interviewing skills, like, you know, if you're going to interview an author, read their book first. I've done interviews where the first thing the author says to me is, have you read the book? You know, and if you don't say yes, then your interview goes south pretty darn fast. So, you know, I talk about things like that. I talk about good interview questions to offer. And I just give people samples of the kind of interviews I've done over the years and what works and what doesn't work.
And one of the promotions you've put down here is it's guaranteed to be the most fun you'll ever have at a writing class.
Well, I certainly hope it is. I mean, there's an aspect of any sort of teaching or lecturing that's a lot like performance. I try to be quite entertaining in my presentations, and I try to pass off good information as well. Arts writing, because by definition, arts writing is writing about the arts. The arts, of course, are lively and they're passionate and they're fueled by, you know, big personalities and wonderful creativity. And your writing should reflect that as well. You shouldn't be writing in a dry, dispassionate way when you're writing about the arts. And the people you're connecting with are also those kind of people. So you've got to play on the same field with them. You know, not compete with what they're doing, but certainly show an interest and have enough back knowledge that you can talk about what they do and the world they live in from a knowledgeable perspective.
And I'm looking at the clock. Believe it or not, time is running by quickly. But I think most people, and myself included, know you. I know you'd moved up to UVic in a new capacity,
yeah.
But I know you as the former editor of Monday Magazine. Mm. And without putting you on the spot too much, do you miss Monday Magazine and that type of role? Very different than what you're doing now as a writer.
Well, do I miss Monday? yes and no. I mean, I worked killer hours when I was at the paper, like crazy hours, like 60-hour work weeks some week. And it was a wonderful time. And, you know, the people I worked with there, like the editors I worked with, Ross Crawford, Lisa Gordonier, people like that, I learned so much from. And then when I was the editor, I felt our team was really good. Jason Humans and Bill Stewart and Amanda Farrell Lowe, I felt we had a really good core team going on there. So I miss the people sometimes. But I'm happy now to not have the crazy hours. I'm still active in the art scene. I'm still writing about the arts for CVV magazine online, so I'm still out there in the city mixing with the scene. And, you know, and I've got this 20-odd year memory of things in Victoria that I just didn't want to let go of. So even though I left the paper, I did not want to stop writing about the city's art scene, because that kind of long-term memory is quite invaluable, and there's really only a handful of journalists in the city who have it.
Okay, John, I think we'll have to leave it there. Thank you for coming on today, and also thank you to our first half guest, Steve Noyes. Thanks for listening. Take care of one another out there.